Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, how are you? This is Cliff, your host of Earth Ancients, startling new discoveries from our planet's distant past, and it is Saturday, August 9th. We're starting to get into the end days of summer. I hope you're all doing well, wherever you're listening from. I'm broadcasting live from Oakland, California, and it's a little overcast today, but we're probably going to have another nice day. We always start the program with current events, and I always have people go to our Facebook page, which is where there is amazing bits of information and references and articles on all things ancient Earth. I wanted to point out the surveys of Raymond Lane, Raymond Lane Jr., who was an associate of Bill Donato, who was the archaeologist we had on a couple of weeks ago. During Bill's talk with us, he had mentioned a number of surveys that were done in the late 1990s, and he happened to find one which has some amazing anomalies that you can see. And one of the anomalies that he mentioned was the fish mound in the Bemini region. They're not salt flats. They're more like flats that have these unusual stone anomalies cut into them. And you can't really tell when you walk across these anomalies because they're so big that you don't know what you're walking on. The photograph that I posted on August 6th, and the title is Bemini Island Anomalies, actually shows this fish mound. And the thing that was actually revealed from this photograph, and this is one of about, I believe, 15 or 20 that Bill Donato will be publishing at some point. The unique part of this is that it appears that these mounds and these designs were cut and formed for viewing at an elevated level. So what does that mean? What does that mean to us when we hear that kind of language, an elevated level? Well, to be blunt, it's only can be seen if you're in the air flying, if you're floating above the surface of the planet and looking down. And according to Bill, this is one of just a number of anomalies that have surfaced over the years as the water is receding in that part of the world, the Bemini Islands. So take a look at it. It's August 6th. The title is Bemini Island Anomalies. And it's a red print of a survey that was taken, I believe, in 1998. The other area, there's other two areas I want to talk about today real briefly, is the ruins in Mexico. Calcatzigul is a place in Mexico that has was excavated, well, probably about 20 years ago. But it's very unusual because most of the carvings that depict people show them wearing helmets. And the Maya and the Olmec apparently have various figures that wear helmets. And so most people would say, well, this isn't a big deal because they wore them to battle. Maybe they were ceremonial, or maybe they were added by the artisans. But the unique part of this central highland part of Mexico is this ruin that dates to 1500 BC, and they've only just begun to scratch the surface. The thing that's unique about the actual depiction of this figure with the helmet is that these people apparently are contemporary to the Olmec. And there's a number of Olmec sculptures and figures that are wearing helmets and have been noted by a number of so-called ancient alien theorists that these are pilots and they're flying in ships and things like that. I don't support ancient alien theorists. I think if it was a helmet for sub-zero conditions, they are Earth human. The other thing, and probably the most important part of this discovery, is that it shows that these people and the Olmec were contemporaries of the Maya. And we know that because this carving is almost identical to a carving and a graph or a relief that was discovered in Guatemala and at a place called El Mirador. And this sculpture, I'm going to place the comparison before the end of this weekend to show you. And the archaeologist in charge of that excavation at El Mirador basically blows the lid off of the historical past of the Maya. And in my feeling, in a tradition of the Maya, that they're actually very, very ancient. And this begins to show that tradition, those oral traditions, are actually true. So take a look at it. Called the posting is The Unknown Chaquisico People of Mexico. There's a number of photos of these individuals with these helmets. Oh, and perhaps the most startling of all of them is a figure that seems to be in a capsule of some kind with exhaust coming out of the back. So you can take a look at it. And hey, I appreciate any kind of feedback, any kind of response to that, because that's what it's all about. We're all about learning, communicating, and discussing what we have discovered here. So have a look at that. So today's guest, I'm really excited about today's guest. You know, the thing about these discoveries when it's prehistory is we have to fall on the word of archaeologists and anthropologists. And what I've discovered through the works of Chris Dunn and Robert Breval and even geologist Dr. Robert Schock is that the archaeologists and the anthropologists don't see things from a technical point of view. They see it from a historic point of view. And it's turning out a lot of their claims, a lot of the history of our planet is incorrect. And really the way to see these is from a technical point of view, from construction, from the tools that may have been used in creating these, creating buildings, creating pyramids, creating monoliths. And so today's theme is engineers of the ancient world, aliens need not apply. And our guest today is Dr. Arlen Andrews Sr. I'll tell you a little bit about Arlen in a second, but the focal point has constantly been, what is the proof from an engineering point of view, from geologist point of view, their ancient sites and the land around it, the weathering, and just how old are these people and how sophisticated were they? A lot of people want to say, well, where is the proof in the machines? Where are the machines that cut these stones? Where is the technology behind the observatories to study the stars, the heavens? You know, to date, there isn't any high-tech machinery that's been found that cut the blocks that formed the pyramid, the Great Pyramid in Giza, or a lot of the ancient buildings in Peru, Cusco, Sacsayhuaman, places like that, that had these huge, massive stones that were cut with such a level of precision that they must have had some form of machinery. But let's introduce the my guest today, and we'll bring him on, and we'll talk a little bit about his points of view. So today's guest is Dr. Arlen Andrews Sr., who's a registered professional engineer and a former White House fellow in the White House Science Office, Office of Science and Technology Policy. Dr. Andrews was at the White House. He wrote the first government endorsement of nanotechnology in 1993. Dr. Andrews retired from the Sandia National Laboratories in Albuquerque, New Mexico, as a manager of the Advanced Manufacturing Initiatives Department, and he co-founded the Muse Technologies, Inc., which was a virtual reality software firm, which was listed for several years. He co-founded a biotech processing company called Kinetic Biosystems, which is now in Durham, North Carolina. Dr. Andrews previously held positions at AT&T, Bell Laboratories, and White Sands Missile Range, New Mexico. He retired in 2013 as the environmental director of the at the Naval Air Station, Corpus Christi, Texas, and he holds 6 patents. What's fascinating about Dr. Andrews is he has published over 500 articles, stories, books, columns on subjects ranging from science fiction, technology, politics, in hundreds of venues worldwide. He's a life member of Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, and his work has appeared in Amazing, Omni, Analog, and a number of science fiction magazines. Dr. Andrews, how are you? Welcome to the program.
Good morning, Cliff. Glad to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yes. We both, well, actually, you came up with the title, Engineers of the Ancient World, Aliens Need Not Apply. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what that title is all about and why you feel that the question of ancient aliens in the development of ancient mankind isn't really a focal point for you, and why you believe that Earth humans are the ones who were the initiators of advanced technology. Just tell us a little bit.
I'll give my background. I've been interested in this sort of thing for the last 60 years or so. I read a lot, and I've traveled a little bit. Like I said before, today's conversation is not a lecture on my part. It's going to be a conversation between you and me and whoever else calls in. I'm going to share a different way of looking at some of the controversies and mysteries. I have a viewpoint that might not be too common, but it's a methodology that served me well personally over the years and everything I've done. I call it thinking like an engineer. And I just want to tell everybody to start with, I'm not going to get into spirituality, but just things that can be touched. I'm not going to talk about religion because that's a personal recognition of how you interface with the universe, in my opinion. I won't be getting into contemporary politics, warfare, or anything else that I consider to be, you know, unproductive. I call it thinking like an engineer. And the way an engineer thinks is you define the problem. You identify your question, situation, your need, your requirement like an engineer does. You assemble the facts that you think are real. And use all the existing knowledge where you can. And go from there. If there's not enough knowledge or you disagree with what you think the contemporary knowledge is, then you design an experiment or a test. You hypothesize, you perform it, but you also, and this is where many ancient so-called researchers screw up, in my opinion, you have to have, your test has to have be falsifiable. In other words, if I'm going to say this is where Atlantis was, and this is my proof, you also have to say, to be scientific, if these things don't turn out to be right, then I'm wrong. And you'll hardly ever find anybody in ancient alternative history research ever to say I'm wrong. I'm going to say up front, things I present and write about, and I've written in Atlantis Rising, and I've written in Fake, and I've written in a lot of other venues in the alternative 14 field, ancient American. You test, evaluate, and if your test or your hypothesis comes up to be wrong, you admit that and go on. Being wrong just shows that you've tried something that nobody else has. So our current of interest, what I'm coming from is this. Was there an ancient civilization in the distant past? How advanced was it? Was it entirely human? Did aliens have any influence on it? So we define the problem. What evidence is there of past civilizations? What evidence remains of their technologies, if any? And what evidence is there that non-humans were involved? My wife and I were watching Ancient Aliens, and we still watch it because they have some really cool sites that they visit. And I usually turn off the sound and just watch the pictures because I'm really not into that hairstyle. But she said, you know, the ancients were around longer than we were, that period, you know, between Göbekli Tepe and the Great Pyramid.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't need aliens for our technologies. Why would they have needed aliens? And she summarized it in one concise statement, one question that I never had quite articulated. But if you look around you in daily life, our worldwide civilization, we have probes orbiting comets out there 100 million miles away. We have things going under the ocean. We're doing all these fantastic things in medicine, science, electronics, weapons, unfortunately, and things like that. Everything we have in our daily life, we can trace back to the person or the time period or the culture that originated it. Our written records go back 6,000 years. Göbekli Tepe is 12,000 years. And 6,000 years was plenty of time for a civilization just like ours to come out of nothing and to spread around the world, have advanced technology, and then get wiped out by comets or ice ages, volcanoes or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
right.
If you take steam engines or medicine or electronics, we can find the person who theorized it, the person who first built it. Nothing in our daily life that you can identify can ever be shown to be influenced by aliens. If I'm wrong, I'm always open to interpretation and new data, new facts. That's where I'm coming from.
Right, right. It's become almost an excuse, a fallback to when something isn't easily explained, like how a granite block was cut that is part of a ruin that is known to be 5,000 years old, to fall back on, well, if we can't explain it, it must have been the aliens.
That's a leap of faith I call magical thinking. You know, it's like the hand of God did it, or a magician did it, or a ghost did it. I mean, if you go that way, you can never learn anything. But let's go back to that particular thing you were talking about, the granite block and the Core 7. There's a really good show on television now called Ancient Impossible. And last Sunday they had the show on there. They reviewed all of Chris Dunn's work at the Petrie Museum about this ancient Core 7. They did not give him even a mention on that show, but they reproduced his work. I talked to him afterwards. I was more angry than he was. He wasn't that upset, but I was. But basically, my friend Chris Dunn, who I've known since 1978, we've been best friends for many, many years. I went to Egypt with him in 2008. We can talk about that at some point. But basically, he thinks there were advanced machines that did that. Now, when we talk about advanced machines in ancient Egypt, we don't necessarily mean more advanced than we can do, because we can do that today. It just means that it's more advanced than conventional archaeologists give them credit for.
Right.
If you go to the Egyptian Museum of Cairo and look at these things, you can see the toolkit that the ancient Egyptians supposedly used. Now, like Chris points out, over a 2,000 or 3,000 year period, apparently these people made no improvements in their tools and their processes, their knowledge. And now, that's ridiculous. Any human being involved in technical issues is going to be wind up using better tools than his father did or his grandfather, because you learn things, even if it's not scientific.
Right.
Learn, practice, artisans.
Okay, well, let's get into Egypt. Before we move to Egypt, I want to remind our guests that you can call in, and at some point in the next probably towards the end of the program, we'll take questions and answers. The phone number is area code 347-826-9565. That's 347-826-9565. and you can ask Dr. Andrews a direct question as long as it pertains to the subject that we were covering today, which is engineering in the ancient past. So, Dr. Andrews, let's go to Egypt. Egypt is a fascinating place. I do know Chris Dunn. I don't know him well, but I have had him in a program in the past. His books are amazing. His recent book on ancient technology in Egypt is fascinating, and it kind of takes us beyond the ancient Giza power plant, which is his first book. So why don't you tell us a little bit of what is important about Chris Dunn's work and what you discovered. I believe you actually did some traveling with him, didn't you? You did some research work with him while he was in the Giza Plateau?
Yes, in 2008, November 2008, we were there for about a couple weeks.
Okay.
All right. I met Chris in Indianapolis in 1978. I had written a letter to the newspaper about the Great Pyramid not being an atrocity but being a work of respect and love. And Chris got in contact with me because he was writing his first book at that time, and we hit it off right away. And at the same time, I was interested. I had come across some references to ancient advanced electricity in ancient Egypt. And so that's been my focus all these years, looking for evidence of that. And I'll be writing about it as I come up with more. But November of 2008, we went over together. He pointed out some of the things that he had found. He showed me the machining on the large statues at Luxor. In the museum, he showed me some undercuts and other things that had to have been done with high-speed machinery because some of the marks you can't get by doing by hand. Later, we went to Giza. And he showed me around there. He and I went into the King's Chamber, the Great Pyramid, and he showed me some resonances and things. And we also went to the so-called Lost Pyramid of Abu Rawash. Mm. Now, on television, I had seen a big thing by, or a big program by Zahia Wasson talking about this being a restricted military base, impossible to get into. Chris and I and the other fellows let us hire a cab, and they drove us straight to it. We paid some bakshish to the guy overlooking it, and we went inside and looked around. And Chris showed me a stone that I call the ruby red Rosetta Stone of Abu Rawash. There is a stone that's about 2 feet wide and 3 feet wide and 5 feet long. It's got compound curves on it. Difficult to machine, but the thing that has to be explained by conventional archaeology is how those people put scribe marks on this. They cut away the stone and surfaced it about 50 thousandths of an inch apart across 3 feet, 500 to 600, 700 scribe marks, all concentric with a radius of over 37 feet. Now, that can't be done by hand. It has to be done by some kind of machine and fixturing. You can even see a place, and Chris points this out in his book, Lost Technologies of Ancient Egypt. You can see a place where the tool skipped and made a big cut across a bunch of those. Well, if you're doing something by hand with stone, you don't make a 5-inch mark that jumps across a lot of other scribes. And he's pointed out other things that has to have been a high-speed machine. You're making a cut through stone. Everybody's used a jigsaw through wood. You go through, it goes off a little bit, and you have to back up and start again and try to get a straight line. Well, that little excursion there was done because you weren't doing it by handsaw. If you were doing it by handsaw, you would have seen immediately, and you would have backed off and done it right. Well, many places.
Right.
And he's the only person ever to have pointed it out. He uses his background of many, many years of machining and advanced machining to find these anomalies that, you know, your ordinary history educated Egyptologist is not going to find it because they're not looking for it. And I'm not putting them down.
Yeah.
Chris and I don't do that. We don't put them down. I think it's wonderful that people spend their entire lives trying to figure out the inscription on a canopic jar. Does this belong to 1450 BC or 1460 BC? I'm glad. I wish we had more people like that. We're interested in things
right.
They haven't looked at. And
well, let's talk about this. This is something that I'm glad you're on the program for. So Chris there's no way that he can hypothesize what kind of machinery was used in the cutting of hieroglyphs. He does talk about giant saws and actually gives evidence, well, not evidence, but he gives hypothesis or his theory behind these giant saws that may have cut blocks. But in your estimation, when you see the precision of the hieroglyphs that are cut into this granite, a very hard stone, what do you feel is the manufacturing, or what's the technology that would do that? Is it something that we have today, or is it something that you think was created in a whole different paradigm of science that was used to cut, like plasma torches or something? What do you feel about that kind of work?
I went into great detail in my one appearance on Ancient Aliens 3 years ago, and they cut it most of it out, which I gave credit to Chris Young for pointing this out to me, and I looked at it and observed it. If you look at the bottom of some of these cuts on the obelisk hieroglyphs, you can see rotary motion at the bottom of it, and then it looks like whatever it was picked up, stepped up, came back a tenth of an inch, and went back down in. So that's what happened. They had to have some kind of step and repeat machine to do that. Now, Chris thinks it was, fairly advanced machines to do that. I don't know. I'm not an expert on it like he is. Now, I did write one of the forewords to his book, Lost Technology of Ancient Egypt. And in there, it covers some of the topics you mentioned before, like what happened to the machines, where are they, and that sort of thing. A couple of recent things have come out about that relevant to that. Just a few weeks ago, they finally found the very first tool that was used on constructing the temple in Jerusalem. They found an iron chisel. That's the only tool that's ever been found. That was a huge place. So it's not difficult to imagine that the old tools were processed metal was recovered, became valuable during times of cataclysms and rebuilding society, and became weapons, became pins. Even I was reading about ancient Greece. Those temples are a lot closer to our time than ancient Egypt. And they still can't find the tools that the ancient Greeks used to carve some of those beautiful temples they had. Now, as far as the drawings, how they did it, they found a courtyard, I think Ephesus or somewhere, they found a stone courtyard in which apparently the architect had drawn out two dimensions on the ground what the front of that building was going to look like. So that's how they did it. They didn't have a lot of paper. They didn't have CAD machines. That was one of the processes. I thought that was beautifully done. I wish people had talked more about that.
But the thing that's odd, Dr. Andrews, is that we have at this evidence these obelisks that weigh in excess of 1,000 pounds. We have just very, very precise and skilled cutting. Chris talks about the Great Pyramid being a power plant, but what do you say regarding powering these machines? Because, a tool that cuts into granite has to be moving at a great rate of speed to be able to pass through granite. Obviously, I don't know, maybe you can clarify, but is normal steel strong enough and sharp enough to cut into granite at the depth and the speed and the precision that we're talking about?
Supposedly the ancient Egyptians didn't have iron, much less steel. I wonder about that sometimes. They haven't found any. Down in Zimbabwe, like thousands of years even before the ancient Egyptians, somebody in ancient Zimbabwe was making steel, and I wish people would look at that more. I don't know. Chris would have to answer those. Archaeologists like Protzen and Chris Dunn will have to tell you about what can cut what. I just know from the evidence I've seen, it had to have been a step and repeat type of machine, which meant they had some sort of fixture. They had something that guided what they did, because it couldn't be done by hand. You're not going to get those straight lines. You're not going to get those step and repeat swirls, rotary motions at the bottom of those hieroglyphs like you showed me. It's a mystery. Again, the ancients had many thousands of years of unrecorded history. Between Göbekli Tepe and the Great Pyramid is 7,000 years or more. And they could have had machines as advanced as we have, and that they used them. And during the earthquakes and wars and famines and plague and invasions that they had, all that stuff was recycled or taken away. My hope is that someday, at the bottom of some sand pit over there, we're going to uncover an ancient machine shop that shows exactly what they did.
I would love that.
I would, you know, if somebody does dig up a flying saucer in the sand, hey, I'll take that too. I write science fiction.
Exactly.
My take is any advanced technology we find, more advanced than what we can do today, I would more easily ascribe to an ancient civilization that's been wiped out than to ancient aliens. I don't like magical thinking. I don't like if you think that aliens did it, then we probably have no chance of ever figuring out what it was or how they did it. But if we say humans did it, then, you know, we're humans, and we're probably ever been as smart as they were, and we might be able to figure it out. At least studying it this way leads to discoveries, and I've made some myself, which we can talk about at some point.
Okay. Before we leave Egypt, I want you to tell what your theory or what your feeling is on where this technology may have happened. Now, if you believe that it's a natural progression in that time from between Göbekli Tepe and the ancient ruins of the Giza Pyramid, then perhaps it was a technology that was evolved through R&D, but it leaves us with so many questions. What is the power source? What generated the power? We're discovering through various research efforts in the Americas, John Burke's work on electromagnetic fields, telluric fields, that there's natural energy that the Maya were able to amplify through their pyramids. This is not fantasy. This is not a guess. This is hard data that John and his team have uncovered. My question to you is, these immense edifices, the pyramids, the pyramid buildings, the temples that are made up of these megalithic multi-ton stones had to have been cut with machines that were powered with certain types of energies. Do you have any feelings or any idea about what that was, what the power sources were, any testing that may have come up as an engineer that would give you a hint that maybe they used a certain form of energy that we're not aware of?
That's kind of outside my field of expertise. I can just say I don't know. Now, on the Great Pyramid, let me tell you how I got interested in it to start with. I read Charles Hapgood's book, Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, back in about 1967. I was in grad school. And they were talking about these maps of Antarctica and North and South America thousands of years ago. And they had the Portolans system, which was a way of measuring actually latitude and longitude. And they said, oh, the prime meridian for this map went through Alexandria, Egypt, is what Hapgood said. And I looked at it and I said, no, I looked at it, and I figured it went through Giza, which is another degree off. And so it dawned on me then, my first hypothesis thinking about these things in old times was that as an engineer, I'd taken a lot of courses in surveying, base markers. You put down base markers, a monument from which you want to remap things. So I thought, as an hypothesis, what happened if there had been an ancient civilization? Most of it was wiped out, but some of the survivors made it to Egypt. And they wanted to build a base marker from which to remap, resurvey the entire world. Well, the Great Pyramid has been there a long time. Now, 2500 BC might not nearly be old enough for it. So I had the feeling that somebody built that thing. And from there, they mapped out the rest of the world. And so back in those days, without Google Earth or anything, it was kind of hard to do. But I worked out that it was great circles. The great circles would be laid out around the world, and they would build their monuments at other places. And so in 1976, I came across Peter Tompkins' book, Secrets of the Great Pyramid, and I said I was more convinced than ever that I was right. So I had a friend at Bell Labs using an ancient computer, advanced for those days, who did a series of great circles around the world for me. And the first one I gave him had about half a dozen monuments of it, like Easter Island and Nazca and Giza and places. I was shocked. So I worked out a world grid back there in 1976. I was starting to write a book about it, but about that time, a lot of people came out with their own Earth grids. Not very well. They got most of it. They still don't have it all. So I kind of dropped that project, and I was doing a lot of personal stuff at the time, divorce and remarriage and everything else. So I kind of dropped it. However, part of my feeling at that time was that ancient, sensitive, psychic shamans, whatever you want to call them, would search out certain parts of the world and say, this is where we're going to build. Now, again, this is hand-waving woo-woo. I have no proof of it, but that was my feeling. And when I went to Stonehenge in 1973, I had that feeling spade there. I thought, wow, this is something powerful is going on. I don't know what these energies are. I've written a song that will be produced by Dr. Catherine Asaro, who's a songwriter, producer, science fiction writer, and, by the way, astrophysicist, called Ancient Ages, that captures what I feel these places were, ancient energies, as you talk about, exactly what you're talking about. Whether people were to capture those and utilize them as we do windmills or things today, I don't really have a clue. I was interested in ancient electricity, so we went to Dendera, Chris and I and the other fellows, and in the crypts of Dendera, the so-called light bulbs. Those were not the most interesting. There were other engravings, bas-reliefs there that showed other devices to me that looked like batteries, electrical devices, that sort of thing. And Chris and I walked around Dendera for several hours together, and I came up with the idea that just something I looked at as an engineer, I really think that a lot of the underground parts of Dendera and maybe other places in Egypt were carved out in the sunlight in open air first. Then they were buried and sealed together and, you know, became underground crypts. I don't really see how a lot of that stuff could have been done in the cramped quarters in the darkness. I don't think they had fluorescent lights down there. So I think this is just a trivial example, but an engineer's observation, which he agreed with. A lot of these wall carvings had to have been done in the open air, in the sunlight, then disassembled and taken down and put underground.
Okay.
We know that can be done because in the 1960s, we ourselves, the human race, took apart Abu Simbel and moved it up 200 feet so that Lake Nasser wouldn't submerge it when the Russians built that dam. So that sort of thing has been done, will be done. Again, it's just a one small bit of knowledge that I think people didn't have before. All it takes really is a couple of engineers. You know, and you might, I'm not bragging about engineers, you might get artisans and artists and sculptors to go through as part archaeological teams and see, this sculpture here means such and such. The modern sculptors, it might have meant the same thing to the ancient sculptors.
Right. Right.
You need more than just Ivy League professors. I'm sorry. I'm not putting anybody down in particular.
Yeah.
Not that there's anything wrong, but we need to do something beyond that. There's a show out in a new field of research called Big History that goes all the way back to the Big Bang and brings it up to modern times. I think we need something like Big History. I mean, Big Archaeology. Do the same sort of thing. Let's go back 30,000, 40,000 years and see if we can find evidence that there were other advanced civilizations around the world at that time.
Right.
With that paradigm in mind, then, that opens your mind to a lot of things. And you could be wrong. I could be wrong.
Your interest in electricity in Egypt, you spoke a little bit about it when you and Chris were down looking at the sculptural reliefs on the wall, but When you say you had an interest, was it just that you were curious about what power the machines, or did you stumble upon something that kind of piqued your interest and you began to do some research regarding ancient electrical devices?
I was an engineer at Bell Laboratories, and telephones were a big thing. And I came across some tongue-in-cheek articles about ancient telephones. But then I started looking into it, and I actually came across a couple of serious articles about wiring and other components of primitive telephones that were found in Egypt and India and China. I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. If you've got thousands of years and you've got, and your boss tells you, I want a way to talk from this point here 100 feet through the temple wall of somebody else, and you got nothing else to do and the threat of torture and death if you don't do it, you know, that's a big incentive. It worked well for the Nazis and the Soviets. That's how they operated, and they probably worked in the old days too. And like a friend of mine said, if somebody tells you, I want pyramids built, and you've got 50 years to do it, and if you don't do it, we're going to feed you to the ants a bit at a time. You're probably going to get together with all the people you know and everything you can find out and experiment with and try to figure out how to do it. I don't think that the ancient things were built that way. I'm being facetious here. People say, what about the pyramids? People working themselves to death. Maybe they did, but people worked on cathedrals in medieval Europe for 100, 200 years. They did that first for a job, a place to stay and eat. But they also did it out of love for the church and God and maybe respect for the king or whoever running things. So right. All the ancient stuff, I view things as testimony to respect and beauty, and I don't view them as necessarily as atrocities.
Mm-hmm. When you look at the Great Pyramid, and we're going to leave Egypt here in a minute and go to South America, but one of the last things I want to ask you, when you look at the Great Pyramid, the sheer size of the of this ruin and the accounting of the average block weighing 2.5 tons, what do you feel would have been the purpose of such a huge monument? And what we see today isn't even the complete piece. It doesn't have the casing stones, the outer stones, the white stones that would have made it a beautiful, beautiful piece of work. But just the feat of engineering alone is mind-boggling. And the conventional theory is that it was man, you know, that hauled those stones up. I don't know how tall is the pyramids? Over 200 feet high, right? It's a monster.
480 feet high, I think.
480 feet high. So, I mean,
it was a taller
from an engineering perspective, what would you say about that in terms of a conventional thought?
Well, it was the tallest building on Earth until the Eiffel Tower in the 1800s. The tallest man-made building. I was recording my own thoughts when I walked up to it that day, and I can't play those on the air because they were pretty profane, but it's awesome. It's the most awesome thing I've seen since I first visited the Grand Canyon, which goes in the other direction. You already have my idea of why it was built. I actually think it's much, much older than the 2500 BC they attribute it to. It could have been there many times longer than that. In fact, there are some researchers, I can't get into it because I don't have the knowledge and I'm not really interested in that, but that it was there first and the other pyramids around it were built later. Perfection was there first and all the lesser things were built after that. I don't know. But like I said, my friend Chris Dunn pointed out a lot of anomalies inside. He was trying to explain every single feature of it, and I asked him one time, I said, if you're going to do this, why don't you predict what's on the other side of Gatenbrink's door? He said, well, you know, okay, I'll think about it. And he did. He wrote it up. It's on his website, GizaPower.com. And he showed what he thought would be on the other side. Well, and the thickness of the block, he was off by a quarter inch on the 5-inch thickness. And I thought after 5,000 years, a quarter inch is pretty good shooting in the dark like that. But also the fact that they found those copper, he called them electrodes. They're not, obviously, they're not handles or anything else like that. They were, and the other side, last year, year before last, they found what looks like to be some red markings of electrical diagrams, how this thing was to be wired up. He thinks the whole thing was invented to produce microwave energy that was transmitted out of the shafts in the, I think, the King's Chamber. Other people have had other ideas. When I read Peter Tompkins' book on the Great Pyramid, he mentioned a book called The Pharaoh's Pump by Edmund Kunkel. And so I got in touch with Mr. Kunkel when I moved to Indiana. I never went to see him. He gave me permission to rewrite his book, another one of those projects that sounded interesting, but I never got around to. Kunkel hypothesized that the inner workings of the Great Pyramid amount to a hydraulic ram pump. And, in fact, based on that, he worked out how it would have worked. He built a scale model of it, which did work. He also got a patent on it back in about 1956 or so. Edward Kunkel, K-U-N-K-E-L.
Yeah, I've seen his work. Yeah.
Yeah, he hypothesized that not what the pyramid was built for, but just how it was built. He said that it was built this way by having a course of stone into which you pumped water, and then you had a series of locks and canals, locks and gates that let you go in and float the stones in place on water on boats. And it would have been probably a pretty good job for people in ancient times. You're standing in waist-deep water or chest-deep water, pushing a raft around with a big stone on it. And if you read his book or read other books about it, you can see how it possibly could have been built. I think Stephen Myers has got some books out on it. John Cadman has got books out on it. They've each done research in these areas. And there's no reason why it couldn't have been built that way and also be used for the purposes that Chris Dunn talks about. Because I don't think any of Chris's predictions have yet proven wrong. He predicted that there would be some way to measure the level of water, and when they found those electrodes in there, he said, okay, if you had conductive water and it got up to those levels, then this did something else. My prediction is this. If those are indeed electrodes in those doors that they found, then somewhere nearby there has got to be an access panel and chambers leading to it so a person could at least crawl in there and do something to the terminals, hook them back up or something. So my prediction is they explore beyond that. They're going to find a place, moving stones, that where human beings could get in and adjust things. I mean, it's a machine of some sort, and the machines need adjustment.
So your feeling is that the Great Pyramid is a machine?
I think so. I think so. It's had nothing to do with burials of kings. Let me tell you why. Inside the Great Pyramid, I was there. Not a marking anywhere of anything. Nothing on the sides, nothing in the king's chamber, nothing on the so-called sarcophagus. Down in Thebes, Luxor, we visited a place called Deir el-Medina. I was looking for some evidence of my electrical stuff, but it doesn't exist there anymore. The French recorded it, but it's been since destroyed. We were looking, we found some old, we went to a tourist place, a tomb of a local mayor or some little functionary. We walked in this tomb, it was 12 feet wide, 8 feet high, and 20 feet long. Every square centimeter of that thing was covered in hieroglyphs and paintings and stars and the Book of the Dead and the instructions on how to get through the afterlife. That was just a minor functionary nobody's ever heard of. Don't you think if the inside of the pyramid was built for a king, a pharaoh, he likewise would have had everything there too, carved and embossed and everything else? No, there's nothing in there. You go to the Valley of the Kings, and every pharaoh that was buried in the Valley of the Kings, as you walk down the 100 feet down to where their sarcophagus was found, you see, again, Book of the Dead, all the gods and goddesses. You see overhead the stars, Newton, all these things. Those tombs, the pyramids were not built that way. And I don't think any of the big three there had anything inside of them at all. So,
yes.
When I saw a couple of ladies in there meditating, doing the Om business, and I meditate too, but not inside the Great Pyramid, I told Chris, I said, this is like somebody 10,000 years from now meditating down in the ruins of Hoover Dam or inside an air conditioning duct. I mean, that's about the
Well, you know, maybe there's some unseen energy in there that we don't know about, that sensitives can pick up, and that's why they're meditating in there. Who knows? Hard to say.
I put those kinds of things in my science fiction stories. I've got stories in Analog Magazine about 30,000 years from now, about after the next ice age, and I've got one coming out in Analog next month, back in the November issue, called Flow, which is about, again, some people surviving 30,000 years from now and how they look back on ancient times. My own research in this area has kind of informed the stories that I write about other things. So,
interesting.
Let's move to
South America. You've done quite a bit of writing on some of the ancient areas of Peru. And in an article that you wrote, Atlantis Rising, you describe the Siwatwait stone in Peru. And actually, I found an interesting video that you did with Brian Forster on this, what appears to be a hydraulic model. And what's unique about it is when people first look at it, it looks like a monolith that has been, you know, designed in a way. You know, first appearances, it's like some kind of a design. But you found out that it's much more sophisticated than just a simple design. Why don't you tell us a little bit about that?
Okay, I mentioned before Edward Kunkel and the Pharaoh's Pump. Back in the 1970s, I wanted to create a tabletop model of that I could show to people, maybe give a lecture on. Cutaway models. But I found out that you can't use water. If you scale down the Great Pyramid to 1/100th of its size or 1/1000th of its size, you can't use water to make it work because water doesn't scale down. It's got surface tension, density, viscosity, all those sorts of things. So I worked out at that time what kind of liquid I would need to make that scale model, 4-foot-wide model of the Great Pyramid work. There is nothing. You need something 35 times as dense as water. I found liquid mercury about 13 to 14 times as dense as liquid water. But liquid mercury is toxic and expensive, and I thought, you know, I don't want to mess with this. And then after I met Chris, I thought, oh, let's let this one go too. But on television one time in the 80s, I saw a television show about Peru, and they showed that. I said, my God, that's a hydraulic model. And so then I used that same Reynolds number calculation. I figured that maybe those ancients used liquid mercury. If that really is a hydraulic model for hydrology studies, maybe they used the mercury as well. So I ran into an archaeologist at a science fiction convention, and she said, yeah, she had just come back from Peru, retired. I said, I mentioned the Siwatwait stone. It's called Siwatwait. The Siwatwait stone to her, and she said, yeah, we found mercury on lots of those. We don't know what it's for. I said, I do. But I went off to refill our wine glasses, and I lost her and never found her again, so I've never been able to find out exactly the archaeological reference to that. So I looked at it, wrote the article first, and then in April of 2012, I went down with my son, Sean, and Brian Forster was our guide, and I enjoyed Brian's guiding because he would take us to a place, and here it is. If you want to know what other people think, we'll tell you, but otherwise, here it is. And that's what I want as an engineer. I'm not interested in what the locals think of the thing or New Age people think of it. I just want to do it. So he was able to guide us there and just take us and let us be free to do our thing, which I appreciate. And I wrote an intro to one of his books based on that. The Siwatwait stone, 13 feet long, and it's raised about 4 feet in the middle. It looks like a stone that was egg-shaped originally. My take on it, to start with, and looking at it, I'm more convinced that the ancients used it for hydrology studies, maybe to train their engineers and artisans who went out and actually built these things. I looked up the archaeological studies of it. There are a couple of papers about it. And a couple of the other archaeologists from the University of the Andes in Colombia there said that whoever made this was equivalent of a Newton of the Andes, you know, or an Einstein. It had other features they'll talk about as for hydrology. But I'm the first one to suggest that it be used, that maybe liquid mercury was used. It turns out not that too far away, a place called Hualavica, something like that, there were cinnabar mines. If you take cinnabar, which is a yellow cake material, and put it in a pot and apply fire to it, heat to it, you get liquid mercury out. So they had a lot of liquid mercury. Spaniards exported that. They were able to use mercury to separate gold, that sort of thing. And they they exploited the Indians and made them mine this stuff. But so not far away, there was liquid mercury available. This archaeologist told me they had found liquid mercury on it. I took a liquid mercury testing set there with me that day, but I couldn't find any evidence of it. I'll have to say that. I was hoping to find it. But if it's been sitting out in the open for many, many, many years, who knows what's been wiped away. And I would need to go back with some kind of electronic scanning device to pick up whatever surface materials are there. My other goal someday is to go back to that site with a handheld 3D scanner, and scan the entire thing into three dimensions, and so then we can prove how these things work. I found some, I won't go into it here because I'm going to write about it again, but basically I found some evidence of repair in a few places. It looked like maybe they had decided to channel the water in another direction.
Okay.
A lot of the channels were 1.1 inch wide, which seemed to be a common measurement that they had for some reason. And if you look at it, liquid mercury would scale down, and if you pour liquid mercury from the top of it, it would show you how water would operate if you had something that was 100 feet wide. So it would work.
Have you or anyone been able to determine what the landscape is that was carved on that monolith? It's not Cusco, the city Cusco. It's not Sacsayhuaman. I mean, what area is it? Where is it located? It's a scale model of something, right?
I think it was a scale model to show different construction techniques. It wasn't necessarily any one place. For example, if you look at the pictures of it on the web, or my article there, you'll see in one place it looks like a series of steps coming down from the top. There's a lake at the top or a bowl at the top, and there's a series of steps. Well, in ancient times, even in modern times, people used that with water to slow down the flow of water. It's easily done. You make a series of terraces. When the water rolls over it, it slows down. You use up some of the energy so you don't have a torrent hitting the bottom where you have a well or a dam or something. At the bottom of it, at the very bottom of it, before the water runs off, you'll see a series of what looked like laid down interlaced fingers. And that was the first clue when I first saw it back in the 80s. There were, I forgot exactly how the pronunciation, basically small canals. The ancients in the Peruvian desert had an irrigation system called microclimate. They would irrigate areas, and they had raised areas of earth between them laid out like fingers. But those raised areas were only like 5 to 6 inches high, and in that they would plant their crops. And the Spaniards, of course, mostly destroyed all that stuff out of ignorance, stupidity. But in modern times, they started to use it again. Because it turns out at nighttime, if you have water standing just a couple inches deep next to these raised earthen mounds that are just a few inches high, a microclimate forms. That means the water raises up, and it forms a fog blanket over these areas, and it makes the crops grow out in the middle of the desert. And the Sowaiti stone has that in several places. The Sowaiti stone has areas where you have long straight runs, and then they curve around. There's some evidence of what we call the Bernoulli principle. If you're running water, Romans used this in their aqueducts. If you're running water, an area that's got a high drop in it, you can make the channel wider and the water runs slower. you want to make the water run faster, like you want to have it run into a fountain, you narrow the channel. Just like you do when you use water your hose in the garden, put your thumb over it, and you can make it go fast, or you can take your thumb off and the water goes into certain rooms. So those ancients had worked that out. You know, I don't know if they calculated it or they did it by experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But it was their people always wondered how could they have maintained a huge population out in the middle of the desert. Well, because they had advanced agricultural technology that wasn't rediscovered until the 1900s. And that
right.
shows it. In my opinion, if had people studied this stone before, 100 years before, maybe they figured out what it was and advanced that new technology. Again, we've learned something from looking at that. And there's probably a lot more to learn as we get.
My question for you as an engineer, would you say that that's pretty high level science that went into that hydraulic study? Or would you say it's like, well, you know, it's something, would you say it's something that without computer modeling, which is what we would do today, that's pretty close to the same? Or would you say it's very rudimentary?
They did not have, as far as we know, you know, 3D CAD drawings, but they did have stone. And they had the idea. There was some very clever, enlightened person or persons in those days said, you know, we need to figure out how this water is going to work when we bring it down from this spring on top of a mountain. Because if you just cut a hole, it's going to run out and destroy everything. So let's figure out how to slow the water down. Let's figure out how to capture it, release it when we need to. Let's figure out a way to capture it when it rains. Maybe cover it up.
Mm-hmm.
Sun is out. I don't know if they used what we would call a scientific method or if it was all empirical. Empirical means you just look at it, okay, I do this, this happens. Now,
right.
ancient engineer probably worked like today's engineers. If I'm giving a task to do something and I don't know how to do it, I'm going to experiment around, keep trying, fiddling, twitching with it, tweaking until I find something that works. That's what modern scientists sometimes today say the ancients didn't have science, so they never could have advanced too far. That might be true in some cases, but that stone, the Sewage stone, some of the archaeologists pointed out, if you have enough people there, you could actually tilt it and rotate it. And if so, that brings into effect they use modern hydraulic models, the ability to tilt things that works. So their conclusion, not mine, but some South American archaeologists, conventional archaeologists looked at it and said, you had another Newton here, a Newton of the Andes. That was a brilliant person. Whether they calculated first or just did it by experimentation, the result is the same. I think they used it to teach their artisans, if you're going to make this big run here, you're going to drop it 200 feet, you better figure out a way to slow the water down. If you're going to run it down to these agriculture area, this is what you need to do first. So there are
interesting
300 carvings on there, and it's a lifetime study for somebody. I hope maybe somebody listening to this who's a budding engineer or scientist would like to devote their life to going down. Now, when we were talking about this, and I got online with other people, and I talked to some people in Colombia, University of Andes, they said there are other places in Peru and elsewhere where it looks like people made a model of it before they built the real thing. Which,
wow.
Like people say, it's a lot easier to correct your mistakes in a model than it is if you've built a 500-foot stolen piece out there. And, oops.
Exactly.
I don't think the Inca or the chief is so happy if he spent 5 years building something and it didn't work.
Yeah. Let me ask you a question. You were in Cusco. You've been there, I guess, a few times. Have you had a chance to go inside the pre-Inca temple, inside the Cornacasca? The sun temple. Now, the reason I'm going to ask you about that is there is a number of there's a door that appears to have had channels cut into the door that ran either wires or tubing or some other technology, it appears, that ran through the walls at that sun temple. Have you had a chance to inspect that?
Yeah, I did, and I came to a conclusion, and I found later a publication that showed I was right. It looked to me like that one area, first off, we looked at the one place Brian showed us. The holes are not uniform in diameter. They're not uniformly spaced,
mm-hmm.
and the channels between them are the same way. So this was crude and fast. Do something. And they were all built in this vertical door, this wall. I figured at the time that this was merely used to take some kind of maybe golden statue that the Spaniards stole, hold it up against the wall, flat against the wall, with ropes in the back, holding it up, that so you would see no evidence of protrusions or anything. So there was something big and flat against the wall, maybe a gold idol statue, maybe that's where that big sun disk was, I don't know. Up against the wall. All those channels behind it were places that ropes could have been done and pulled, and we looked at it, Sharma and Brian and I looked at it, and we all agreed, yeah, it looks like that's what it was for. Had it been for, machinery or something else, those holes would have been uniform diameter, uniformly spaced, and they're not. It was no more precise than when you put a few hangers on the wall to hang up a big painting. You want the painting.
Okay.
But these are just, to me, those are holes in the wall. And how they did it, they had some kind of tube drill that nobody's found. But just because, again, because people can't find it doesn't mean it was even advanced machinery there.
Okay.
Everything inside there, except the way the big stones themselves fit, looked pretty crude, very crude compared to anything we found in Egypt. The stuff in Egypt was fine and perfect, and a lot of the stuff in Peru was crude by comparisons.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I see the stonework in Cusco, and I think a lot of it appears to be machine, but it could be another process that is not available to us anymore.
It's beautifully done. It's beautifully done, the way they fit these stones and everything together. But I advise anybody interested in this to read books by Protzen, Protzen. And he wrote some books called Ollantay Tambo, Incas.
Okay.
Ollantay Tambo. And that, of course, that's a $200 book, and I haven't even bought that one. But you can get it from the library. Another one he wrote recently, and I just turned Chris onto it, is called Stones of Tiwanaku, Pumapunka, up in Bolivia. And they showed the actual drawings they made there. They showed the how you could actually make some of those cuts that the wild-haired one on Ancient Aliens said has to be by Ancient Aliens. No, you can do it with obsidian stones and other stones they found there. And they give demonstrations of it. It's not just claiming. Grad students actually went in and spent many, many hours cutting those things out. But, again, it doesn't mean they didn't have technologies we don't know about. I mean, I don't know everything. If I did, I would write all about it. I'm just
yeah.
things from my viewpoint that a lot of these things, there does not have to be a wild explanation. The English lady who was talking about Core 7 on Ancient Apostles the other day, she said, just because we can't figure it out doesn't mean there's some wild explanation for it. We just have to take time out.
I support that because Ancient Aliens is the excuse for anything that is unexplainable, and that just that doesn't cut it. I mean, that's just not the way to look at it. But
Ancient
I want to
Sure, go ahead.
I want to move on to Mesoamerica, my great interest, the work of the Maya and the Aztecs, and I have personally been doing research and following in the footsteps of John Burke's work using magnetometers and other measuring devices, studying the pyramids. And I want you to describe your discovery, your interest in Teotihuacan in Mexico, the massive pyramid, the Avenue of the Dead, and the Mica. Now, that's something that I haven't studied enough about, is when they first began uncovering the Great Pyramid, the Sun Pyramid, I guess, it had a thin layer of mica that unfortunately they took off, but it's actually written about fairly extensive in the archaeological analysis of the building. What do you think that was on there for? Was there a reason for that?
Okay, a little bit of background. First off, a lot of alternative history sources will tell you that mica had to have come from Brazil, 3,000 miles away. But that's not necessarily true. Other people have pointed out there are some mica quarries or sources just 100 miles away that they can trace it to. The an interesting thing was, when I was on Ancient Aliens in September the 1st, I think, of 2011, they had, they wanted me, the questions they asked me, they sent me ahead of time, which I refused. I said, I won't even give you an answer to that. I refuse. Let's just call the whole thing off. Oh, no, no, we've already paid for your trip. You've got to go out there. What questions will you answer? I said, well, they wanted me to say, was the mica on the Pyramid of the Sun and the Avenue of the Dead, you know, Teotihuacan, was that where ancient spaceships landed and used their electronics and stuff? I said, you know, that's like a question, have you stopped beating your wife or your boyfriend or whatever, you know? Wait a minute, you know, you can't give an answer to that. I refuse. I said, I will speculate on how some of the mica was used. On the Avenue of the Dead, when I was there in July of 1983, wow, 31 years ago. Anyhow, there's a big slab of it, probably 12, 15 feet square, under a little tin roof shed, and nobody knew what it was there for. So, out of respect for the money that Ancient Aliens was spending, I went and bought myself a sample of mica from a local shop here, and I looked up the properties of mica and everything else. And this is what I told them on Ancient Aliens Day, which they cut out all of course, because I never used those words, Ancient Aliens. In fact, they cut out, I was interviewed over an hour, and I got maybe 50 seconds on the show. Anyhow.
Wow.
If you can imagine this, I'll make it quick. Imagine this. It's dark. It's a dark evening. The sun is just setting. A lot of people were gathered around this big slab of mica. And this might have happened on the pyramid, too. I don't know. But this big slab there is 12, 15 inches thick. It's a huge floor of it. Imagine there's an idol of Quetzalcoatl sticking out over at the dragon head, you know. And people are watching. There's torch lights all around. The sun has just set. And all of a sudden, the shaman comes out. He's dressed in what they dressed in as the Aztec dancers, you know, the long black feathers all over the robe. And he's got his hand, he's got a wand, a staff. He comes out, maybe the music's playing, whatever instruments they had, they're playing. He shuffles around and does a little shuffling dance. On his feet, he's got rabbit fur moccasins. He walks around and he says, I feel the power in me. And all of a sudden, his feathers and his robe and his headdress start to stand up all over. Mm. And he shovels some more, and there's electrostatic energy building up and making the feathers separate. He goes there finally and touches that metal wand to the head of Quetzalcoatl, and the sticking out of the side of the temple or whatever. And there's a big spark, huge spark. All of his feathers droop. He said, you know, the god has answered me. I have spoken to the god, and power is transferred. Electrostatics. And that would have worked. That would have been a reason to go into all the trouble of bringing a big slab like that in. And this wouldn't necessarily have been a show or a fraud or a hoax. The guy could have actually believed that.
Mm-hmm.
And so this has got nothing to do with ancient aliens or anything. But I'll tell you another use of mica. Same way. They found mica lining the walls of an underground chamber under the Great Pyramid, or the Pyramid of the Sun. So imagine this, and I worked this out, and I ran this past my physics friends who said, yes, this would work. It's never been done, but it could work. Imagine you have a long tunnel that's lined with mica, slabs and pieces and everything else, and you're an acolyte. You've got a bowl in front of you. In the bowl in front of you is a lot of quartz that has gold in it. And somebody has taken a mortar and pestle, you know, mano and matate, and ground all this up. So you have a big mixture of dust in front of you, gold and quartz mixed together. How do you separate that stuff? So you're a priest or an acolyte, and you go down this funnel with maybe your rabbit fur coat on. You're rubbing against this wall. You're building up an electrostatic charge. You get to the end where some idol is, and the feathers that you're wearing are standing up, so you realize the power of the god is within you. There's a great big bowl on the floor. You take the bowl of powdered gold and quartz. You throw it up in the air, step back. Now, the gold is 10, 15 times as heavy as quartz. It falls faster. Quartz is held in somewhat of a suspension electromagnetic field. The gold falls. You pull the bowl back. Quartz goes ahead and falls on the floor. You've got pure gold in your vase. So I ran that past physics friends of mine in Sigma, my science fiction think tank, and they said, yeah, that would work. Now,
okay.
It does. I've just given away a patentable idea. But I think that's a practical application they could have come up with themselves over hundreds of years of experimentation. And that's a use of technology, ancient technology, nobody's ever written about, ever thought of. I had it in an article in Atlantis Rising called Mexico's Mysterious Mica. So there's two uses for mica that I found, one for ritual ceremonial display and another practical one for separating gold from quartz. And that's the kind of thing you can come up with if you look at ancient reports with a modern engineer's mind.
But there's no evidence, as far as you can tell, that it was used to generate any electricity or feed some type of a battery or used for any kind of telecommunications at all.
No evidence of that. I don't think so. Again, if somebody finds something, I'm the first one in line. Hey, congratulations if you found it. I'm still looking for the ancient electrical telephones in Egypt, which is wild, wild and crazy. And I admit I might be wrong, but it's been a pursuit, and it's led me to all kinds of things I would have never found otherwise.
Do you suspect when you hear reports of, as an example, a few years ago there was a report of a vimana found in the Iraqi mountains that the military had discovered and that had an energy field around it that when you came close to it, it basically dissolved you. Finding bits of artifacts like that, technology, would be wonderful because it would explain a lot, but... I mean, when I hear reports like that, you have to wonder if it's true or not.
Well, if it's on the internet, it must be true, right?
That's the problem with the internet. It's hard to validate. Let's take a question right now. This is an email from Facebook from John in New Mexico. He asked this. He says, Dr. Andrews, do you believe that there was an Atlantis? And if so, what was their level of technological advancement?
Oh, yeah. I've already said I believe there was an ancient civilization. When it was destroyed, it probably gave rise to at least one of the legends of Atlantis. Everybody overlooks this. When you read about the only reference we have to Atlantis, real one, other than psychic stuff, is Plato. When you read about Plato, there's an ancient Egyptian priest talking to Solon. It says, you Greeks are like children. You had a history and you've forgotten it. 9,000 years ago, you ancient Greeks fought and defeated the Atlanteans, who were an empire beyond the straits of Hercules, beyond the pillars of Hercules. They invaded, conquered the Mediterranean, but you ancient Greeks defeated them and drove them away. So whatever the Atlanteans had was no more advanced than the ancient Greeks had. Because the ancient Greeks whipped them and drove them away. People overlooked that. So my own feel is that it was a Bronze Age culture, maybe Iron Age, maybe they had steel, I don't know. I do think there was an ancient civilization. My gut feel from all these reports and all the logic I can use is that there was at least one worldwide civilization. They at least had ships that traveled whole world. They mapped the whole world. They might have had electricity. They might have had aircraft, like balloons, hot air balloons. You know, the ancient Inca or somebody in Peru had hot air balloons. And I don't see why that couldn't have been discovered all over the world. It looks like the Egyptians had ancient gliders, what I saw in the museum there in Cairo, that little bird thing. People experimented with flight, and they probably had gliders and balloons. I don't really think they're as advanced as we are. On the other hand, there might be areas that they were more advanced than we are, like, I won't get into psychic stuff, but they might have developed.
Well, that's interesting. Yeah, that's interesting that you bring this psychic stuff up.
It affects things. We can't really measure it, so I don't bring it up. I've written about it, however. I do believe ancients might have. If we hadn't had the Inquisition and we'd had a more enlightened past, we should have taken the people who were sensitive and psychic and had academies where they could go be trained, like Hogwarts or someplace, where you go get training.
Right.
Instead of burning you at the stake, they train you and find out. Now, I don't believe in supernatural. I think it's all just powers and energies that have been overlooked. And it might have been the ancients didn't overlook these things. They might have used them in some areas. I just would like to see some evidence of it, you know.
Let's ask one more question here. This is email. Sandy from San Jose asks, Edgar Cayce describes the technologies of Atlantis with great detail. Why do we disprove what he has to say? That's what she says. I think, Edgar Cayce. What do you think of Edgar Cayce?
Well, Edgar Cayce was hired by a bunch of Texas oil men to discover oil wells, and they went bust. So that part of psychic stuff didn't work. I've interfaced with other psychics who have looked into the Atlantean stuff, and some of it seems to ring true to me. What they did with ancient crystals almost sounds to me like lasers. I don't know. I just don't think you can base your whole view of world history on Edgar Cayce because he was just wrong so many times. I'm always interested in that. Up until a couple of years ago, I was a board member of the Ryan Research Institute in Durham, North Carolina, so I'm totally into all that sort of thing. But as an engineer, I want proof. I want find me if Cayce was right. Show me exactly where. Look for something. If we go find it and dig it up, hey, you're right. I mean, that Om-Seti business in Egypt before, where they used a psychic and archaeological digs, and that worked. That showed that it works, and I do believe it. I can't get into it, but I have been told by a psychic about certain things, and have gone and go and have found them. But it's not repeatable. It's not repeatable. It's not takes a lot out of the person who does it. The trauma is really stress for a real psychic to do some of these things. But I have done it, and someday I'll write about it.
Okay. Wow. Well, it's been a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Andrews. Can you let us know what's coming up for you? Give us an idea. I know I'll go ahead and post your website. Is there any lectures you're going to be giving this summer, the fall? What's up in your world so that we can keep an eye on your work?
Well, on the fiction side of the house, I've got a couple of ebooks, Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com. One is called Valley of the Shaman. It actually incorporates a lot of my ideas of ancient civilizations, but it's set in modern-day New Mexico. There's an anthology of previously published stories and a few new ones called Other Heads and Other Tales. That's also an ebook. I've got a story coming out in the November 2014 issue called Flow, the sequel to another story called Thaw out last year. It takes place 30,000 years now. After the next ice age, and you see what people then think about our time. So everything that I do gets mixed up in everything else that I do. I'm hoping to get back down to Peru. There's another project I am not talking about that's been taking my time for the last year, 2 years. I've learned three-dimensional modeling, CAD modeling, and I've been doing a lot of studies, and I found some really fantastic stuff at another site that Brian took us to, and hope to go down again this year. And I don't know what I would really like to find: Nat Geo, Discovery Channel, even Ancient Aliens. I'll take if they would finance it. I'd like to find somebody to finance me to go back down there with some three-dimensional handheld modeling scanners, so that I can collect 3D data off of several sites, nail it down, come back and put it in the computer and run 3D CAD analyses and show the world what really happens. So I'm looking. Mm. I'm looking for sponsors. I'm open to give talks on any of these things. Right now, I'm catching up on my science fiction writing and catching up on my other research projects. And Brian and Sean and I came up with another theory while we were at Machu Picchu that might be coming out eventually in Atlantis Rising magazine.
Okay, great.
If you look at these things from a modern scientific engineering viewpoint, a lot of things are obvious to you that are not obvious to the academics. So I'm wide open. People can contact me on Facebook, and I'm willing to answer any questions that don't have to do with the next book that I'm writing right now.
Perfect. Hey, it's been a pleasure, and I'm going to go ahead and post more information on you, Dr. Arlen Andrews, and we will look forward to seeing what you discover and uncover in the future. So it's been a pleasure. I want to remind everybody that next week we have John Jensen, who will be speaking on the ancient canals of America. And he is in the process of writing a fascinating book on the subject. And I hope that you'll join us. Also, as always, keep an eye on Facebook, Earth Ancients, Startling New Discoveries from Our Planet's Distant Past. And each day we post a number of articles, information that is easily to acquire. Just go to Facebook, find Earth Ancients, and we hope you'll join us. Until next time, have a great day, and we'll